Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. If it's Scott Braddock, it's the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And so much about Texas is in the news, despite the fact that we're talking impeachment, we're talking about, you know, Syria, we're talking about, it's been crazy. But I posted on Facebook today, Scott Braddock, that this could really be the year 2020 when Texas goes blue. And for the first time, I think what's so sobering about this is not that Democrats are hopeful, it's that Republicans are frightened. That's the real true test of whether it's possible. It's not about changing demographics, although it is in part about that. It really is about, I think, a GOP in disarray. So you told me that there is going to be a Texas House special election in the Houston suburbs. What is the raison d'etre for that, and why could it be a bellwether for 2020?
Well, and a shout-out to all of our listeners on KPFT in Houston. I have to tell you that this is something that's very important in Southeast Texas and for the rest of the state. In Fort Bend County, just down the road in the Sugar Land area, in the Richmond-Rosenberg area, you have a state house special election that is playing out because the former appropriations chairman, a very important position in the state of Texas, Arnie, this is the person who, sort of shepherds the process of putting a budget together for a state where the two-year budget is $250 billion, $250 billion budget. He retired to go to the UT system, the University of Texas system, and so his state house seat is open, and there are a few people running for this seat. There's only one Democrat in the race, and Elise Markowitz is the Democrat. A few Republicans in this race, all vying for this seat. It's coming up just next week in the November special election. And there are a couple of other state house seats that are up for similar reasons because some members of the legislature retired. But this is the one to watch, Arnie, this one in the Houston area, because it's in one of those battlegrounds, the Houston suburbs and the DFW suburbs in particular are seen as fertile ground for Democrats because this is where we saw the changes in 2018.
Right.
In Fort Bend County, where this race is, in Collin County in North Texas, in Denton County in North Texas, Williamson County in the Austin area, and a few other places, where Beto O'Rourke either won the county or came close to winning the county. And these places, even 4 years ago, 6 years ago, Arnie, a couple cycles ago, were rock-solid Republican. And now they're seen as winnable for Democrats because the Democrats were coming within 2 points in some of these places. The state house members who are on the ballot next year, believe me, in those places I just mentioned, they're watching this race as well. Those Republican members of the legislature who are going to have real races on their hands next November. I would expect, and who knows, you know I don't make predictions, Arnie. That's not the business I'm in. I would expect the Democrat to be very competitive here, if not win the seat, if not only for the fact that there is only one Democrat here and there are several Republicans who may split up the Republican vote.
So
and
why,
who knows who
why
turns
is that,
out in
why
a special
is that the
election
case?
In an off year.
Right. I'm confused. Why are there so many Republicans running? Don't they have a primary for this race?
Shouldn't they all be?
Yeah, no, I think it's perfectly fine.
Well, it's a special election, so it's, everybody runs.
I didn't realize that.
So there will be, it's interesting, because whoever wants to hold this seat has to run in several elections. First, they'll run in this special election. Then they'll have primaries next year. They'll start all over.
Okay.
Then they'll have a Democratic and Republican primary in March, and then they would have a November election in November of 2020. But these seats should not just sit open because these members of the legislature do have responsibilities even when the legislature is not in session. And one of the things that we may talk about here is the fact that we could have a special session on gun violence and a few other things. And so those communities ought to be represented and have a seat at the table whenever the... Make no mistake, these are the places. This is what it's all about in this next legislative session and in this next election cycle, Arnie. The Texas House is 9 seats away from flipping from Republican to Democratic control. And you actually, in a couple of weeks ago, right there in the Houston area as well, had one member of the legislature announce his retirement. His seat is not yet up for grabs because of the timing of that retirement announcement. He didn't resign. He just retired. He's saying that he's not going to run again. So that seat probably, I think, is going to go to Democrats. This is a guy named Dwayne Bohack from the Houston area. His seat in 2018, which had been pretty, you know, easy for Republicans previously, although it had been getting a little bit harder, but in 2018, the Republican in that district won his seat by a 47-vote margin. So in the Houston area, in DFW, and a few other places, the Democrats are looking to pick up those 9 seats, and it's totally doable. They can totally get there.
So let me ask a quick question. So in special elections, you don't have primaries? Is that how it normally goes?
That's right. They would all run at once. Now, if
so unusual.
One thing to know is that if nobody gets over 50% next week, then they will have a runoff.
Okay, I capisce. That makes sense.
But it would be between the two top vote getters, no matter which party they're from.
So this is all going to be about getting out the vote, because this is going to be, I mean, most people don't really care about this election as much as they will next year. So it's going to be about organization and getting people out there, unless there are other, important people running on at the same time in this November election?
There are important people, but the parties are very interested in this. State and National Democrats are investing in this race because
they see it
as a bellwether. The Democrat, we should say, has outraised everyone else in this race. In fact, there are about 30 people who are running across 3 districts, Arnie, that are up for grabs. And the 2 other districts, one that's in Dallas, for example, that it's a solid Democratic seat, and nobody expects that to change hands from one party to the other. But this one in Fort Bend County, for a state house race, these are significant numbers, especially for a Democrat in the Texas suburbs. Markowitz raised $294,000.
That's a lot of money.
Yes. In some places, I know that would be a more significant race than a state house race.
Right.
There is one perennial candidate in this race, a guy named Gary Gates, who's a Republican, has given himself $1 million for this seat.
Mm.
And I believe, he last loaned himself $445,000. I love when somebody's self-funding, Arnie, because we were going through the campaign finance reports this week. There's a requirement that all of the candidates have to disclose their finances 8 days out from the election in Texas. And this candidate, he had raised, from other people, he had raised $500. He had given himself $1 million and had spent something like $500,000, something like that.
Oh, God. I that would be my bumper sticker.
Grassroots support.
Yeah, grassroots support. That's right.
Gary Gates.
So this is interesting. You sent me this article this morning. Grassroots conservatives call on Speaker Bonin to resign, arguing the 2020 election is at stake. I think is so funny is the pull quote. Dennis Bonin is going to be a drain on the Republican Party, says, shock, Michael Quinn Sullivan of Empower Texans. Isn't he the guy that sort of put the secret tape out there?
He is. Michael Quinn Sullivan, the spokesman for some Midland oil billionaires. He runs a group called Empower Texans, as you mentioned. That's the group, the dark money group, that secretly taped the speaker and uncovered what is absolutely a lot of folks' fantasy about everything that's wrong with state government in a one-hour recording. Interesting, I keep saying this, and I'm going to repeat it here. Empower Texans is like if you had a broken clock that was only right once a day, if that could possibly happen.
Yes.
For 10 years, they were after the former speaker, Joe Strauss, always saying that he was too liberal and he was corrupt and all of this. Never turned up anything. And Strauss always beat them back in primary elections, for that entire 10 years. The folks who were sort of more in the speaker's camp would beat their Empower Texans challengers for all that time. But this has gotten larger than just the dark money group. Right. So, for example, and this is an important distinction, there's a group from Tyler, Texas, from East Texas, called Grassroots America, We the People. It sounds very, they don't have the best marketing ever. But let me tell you something. It's an actual grassroots group. And, in fact, it's not a dark money group either. They just run a PAC. And, one of the things that they say, which is pretty interesting, whenever people are, asking about whether they can write off their donations to this group, it's not a politically active nonprofit like one of these dark money groups. Instead, it's just a PAC. And in their information, they'd like to say, no, we're not a nonprofit. We don't want, the government telling us what we can do, with the money that you send us. So when you have groups like that joining with Empower Texans to say,
that's an interesting marriage.
Aside, it's an interesting, these groups don't always agree. Joanne Fleming, who's a friend of mine from years past. No one could say she's any sort of a liberal. She's a very extremely conservative activist, and actually one of the more effective conservative activists in this state. I can tell you that there are lawmakers who are afraid of being on the wrong side of, you know, some of these folks. What she said was, if Dennis Bonin is left in place as Speaker going into 2020, he becomes the poster child for Democrats pointing to the Republican Party and saying, this is the party of corruption in Texas. Yeah. The Republican Party needs to take care of it. Yeah. Just as a quick refresher for the listeners, the Speaker was revealed to have been, you know, wheeling and dealing and trying to allow for big money contributors to be on the floor of the Texas House. He was going to give them media credentials in exchange for not spending dark money against who? Against him. He kept saying over and over on this recording, please, he was like, as long as you don't spend money against me, then we're fine. And, you know, I was talking to former advisor to a former speaker of the Texas House just the other day, who was saying, you know, look, the thing with a presiding officer, and we repeat this at Quorum Report a lot, the first standing order of the presiding officer is to protect the institution of the House or Senate, whichever legislative body they're in charge of. And, for example, when Joe Strauss was the Speaker, he was always happy to, just content to sort of take the slings and arrows from these third-party groups, the dark money groups. They would always be attacking him. And sort of the philosophy was, anytime they were attacking him, they were not attacking the members, the other members of the Republican Party.
He was protecting them.
And Strauss, by the way, who would win his elections handily in San Antonio, you know, his actual election for state house, he won, I think, in the last go-around when he was on the ballot. He beat two pretty well-funded challengers with 60%. So he was just fine at home. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of one of the requirements for somebody who's running for speaker, is that they're rock solid back in their district, so they can take those slings and arrows. It just doesn't matter. But if you listen to the tape, Bonin was doing the exact opposite. He was just hoping that nobody would ever shoot at him, that nobody, you know, politically, nobody would ever, you know, spend money against him, attack him. They should just leave him alone. And he was willing to do the opposite, which is pour out the other members of the House and sell them out in order for him to not have any kind of a tough election. So, look, I think voters across the state probably don't have not really gotten into all the details of this. It's kind of complicated, but a couple things. One, I think some of these grassroots conservative groups are right that Democrats, you know, want to paint this picture anyway, and they may do it anyway, right? I mean, if you have a Speaker of the House who...
There or not there,
tomorrow,
they'll do it, believe
it
or
would
not.
Kind of be... Let's say this. It would be kind of political malpractice if they didn't, right? I mean, you have a Speaker who's being driven from office. Let me say this. As one GOP member, a senior member of the Texas House, said to me this week, if you fire somebody, which is essentially what's happening, he's, you know, he said that he's going to retire, that he won't run again for Speaker or the Texas House. If you fire somebody from your business, you don't let them just hang around for months.
Exactly.
Right?
Because
you don't know what they're going to do. This person is volatile. This person is intemperate. This person is, you know, he can't be controlled. And he really has no incentive to behave, you know, in a way that's going to help the Republican Party. Because it's essentially Republicans who have forced him to get out. So that is a liability. And so you have a Speaker of the House who's not helping to elect Republicans going into 2020.
Right. He's a liability.
He's a liability. Right. Well, what you need from a presiding officer who is of the same party as you is somebody who can raise money, get resources. It'd be, you know, the big money donors, they want to give to the leadership, right? They want to give to the governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker. And then the speaker would disseminate money among those incumbent Republicans who need some help.
Right.
Those incumbent Republicans, particularly in the suburbs, like we were just talking about, you know, in the Houston and Dallas areas, so that the House doesn't go to the Democrats.
So they don't have an advocate in that position. They have a black hole, is what they have.
Yeah,
that's exactly what he
is.
Not
a good situation for Republicans.
So let me just say, I took that story about the grassroots conservatives calling on the speaker to resign, and I posted it this way. I wrote, Texas is in play. Light candles, organize the grassroots, and thank dark money for undermining the GOP. They got what they wanted, unlimited clandestine money, and it might be the recipe for their demise of the Texas Republicans. So in a lot of ways, even though you have empowered Texans calling on this guy to resign, in a way, they set this up to create the vulnerability accountability for the Republicans that they claim they care about. So in a way, it's so complicated. You almost need graph paper to figure it out. But the irony is the same people that are calling on the resignation are the same people that set it up for the resignation, are the same people that have been using their dark money basically to sort of control and manipulate the Republicans. It's not good for the future of the Republican Party.
Well, you're exactly right, and it's fear.
It's fear.
It's fear of dark money. These folks, they keep giving into, these groups that are organizing against them. And I keep coming back to the idea that these aren't really Republicans. These are mercenaries. They have certain things that they want from government. Their contributors have certain things that they want from government, and they're willing to use resources to punish those Republican office holders who don't do what they say that they should do. And I continue to argue that it's not about really conservatism or liberalism either. It's about having transparency.
Exactly.
If these people want to spend money, they can do that. But it should be disclosed. Even Antonin Scalia, the known liberal, had said that transparency is what's needed in these situations. Spend as much money as you want, and others people who disagree with that. But spend as much money as you want as long as everybody knows where it's coming from. Don't.
Before we end this conversation, you also mentioned that the RNC and even higher is asking what in the world is happening with the speaker in Texas and will he cost the GOP the state. So it sounds like in a lot of ways, there's a squeeze going on here. If you've got the grassroots saying resign, if you've got people at the top in Washington and higher basically saying what the heck is going on because they understand how important Texas is to not only this next election for the president, obviously we're talking Donald Trump, but also for the future of the Republican Party. Texas is so key. And I just can't imagine that Bannon's going to stick around. It just doesn't make any sense. The squeeze is too great. He really is an impediment to what they're able to talk about. Even with him leaving, he's still an impediment. But with him being there, he is the poster child. So I don't know what it would take to get him out, but I suspect that getting him out is going to be critical.
Yeah, and I sort of think that the only thing that could get him out is if Governor Abbott himself would apply pressure and tell this guy, look, you have become such a liability, you have to go.
And why would Governor Abbott not have stepped up to the plate already? He's smart. He understands the politics of this. He doesn't need the RNC to call him from Washington. Obviously, he sees that this is going to be harmful to him in the long run. He can't lose the Texas legislature. That means that anything he wants to do will not be accomplished. I'm a little surprised that Abbott hasn't stepped up.
Yeah, he's timid, to put it the least, to put it mildly.
I'm shocked.
He is, yes, be shocked, Arnie. He also, we're told, is interested in calling a special session on gun violence, among other things, but that would require some courage here. You did have the lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, a rock-ribbed conservative, going around for the last month or so, arguing that you should have increased gun control. And, of course, the base of the Republican Party was not buying that at all.
Right.
And so, we'll see where this goes. But one of the rumors we've heard is that there could be a special session on gun violence, a quick special session, like a five-day special session between Christmas and New Year's, to put it sort of in the news hole, but then so that Republicans would be able to argue next November that they had done something when it comes to this issue that's so important to folks. But I can tell you that, there's among the members of the legislature not a lot of appetite for that, but it may become necessary.
So you mentioned that the Texas voters are being asked to make it almost impossible to adopt the state income tax. And, of course, like the state of New Hampshire, we already asked the question, but isn't that already impossible? So is a referendum being put to the voters? What's happening that's going to make it almost virtually impossible for people to look at anything other than property taxes and business taxes in order to accrue revenue for the state of Texas?
This is one of those things that's it's sort of trying to rally the troops, and this goes right back to trying to win in the suburbs because the Republican leadership is trying to give suburban Republicans things that they can run on next November. They want to be able to go around and say, we virtually banned an income tax in Texas. The issue, though, is that an income tax is basically almost banned anyway in this state because you have a requirement right now that if an income tax was going to be imposed on Texans, it would have to go to a vote of the people. This was set up years ago because you know folks are very much against an income tax. The old joke in Texas is that you'll have casinos and Baptist churches before you would have an income tax in this state. That was the great Wayne Slater who had said that at the Dallas Morning News years ago. But if voters approve a constitutional amendment next week on this, it says that there would have to be a requirement that 2/3 of the legislature would first have to approve an income tax, and then it would go to voters. So basically, it just makes it
so a supermajority, and then the voters.
Supermajority of the legislature, right? And then it would have to go to voters. But it's already the case that it has to go to voters. So the author of this proposal keeps arguing that it's all about the polls. He says, 70% of Texans disagree with an income tax, and that's why we should make it harder to impose one. The natural rebuttal to that, of course, is that, if only you had to poll Texans first before you could impose one. It reminds me of a debate we had here in this state in 2005 on whether or not to add a constitutional amendment at the state level that said that marriage is between one man and one woman.
Yes.
When Arnie, at the time, gay marriage was already illegal in Texas. It had already been banned.
Right.
And so Republican leadership was asking voters to put it in the Texas Constitution that marriage is between one man and one woman, making it just even harder, quote unquote, for people to get married if they're a same sex couple. And I remember at the time asking voters, why do you support this? Gay marriage is already illegal. It's very similar to this. It's already almost impossible to pass an income tax in Texas. And what people would say, and it's interesting how easy it is to gin some people up, right? People would say, "Well, I'm voting to keep it illegal," and I would say, "Do you understand that there's no way?" I would say, "Do you understand that there's no way to vote on this that would make gay marriage legal? Like, if the measure is defeated, gay marriage isn't going to become legal. It's already illegal." And they'd say, "I'm voting to keep it illegal. I don't agree with that gay marriage stuff."
Right,
so,
right. Hey, it's all about massaging their anger and their hate. You know what it is? And it doesn't matter whether it has a consequence. It matters whether they can make the statement. And this is all about the statement and not about the result. I'm just kind of curious. If you are not allowed to have an income tax in Texas, or it makes it very difficult, what about things like interest and dividends taxes? What about things that don't necessarily say the word income tax? Because in my state, we don't have an income tax, but we do have an interest and dividends tax. We do have a business enterprise tax, which is actually a kind of a tax on wages that's paid by the employer. It's technically on paper not an income tax. So I'm wondering, can you thread the needle in Texas, and have they already tried to thread that needle?
There have not been any attempts like that so far.
Yep.
It's a good question, but I don't think that would go over very well, no.
All right. So last but not least, we've been covering a lot about the California fires, which is just incredibly devastating. And you're always talking about how many people are moving from California to Texas. And I think the floodgates are going to open even more, because there was an amazing opinion piece, Scott, in the New York Times just, I think, yesterday. And it was just so depressing, because this guy basically said, "I don't even consider myself a citizen of the United States. I consider myself a citizen of California. I love my state." And he was talking about how he doesn't know whether he can live there anymore. And it's going to be so interesting to see what the fallout is from these fires and where they go. And Texas is going to maybe change in part because of what happened in California, because those people are going to bring their values with them. And that also may precipitate some political changes for the great state of Texas.
Well, I have to tell you that it's been a priority of Republican leadership in Texas for at least 15 years to recruit people and businesses from California.
I know.
Governor Perry did very well with that, and Governor Abbott kind of picked up the mantle and has run with it. But you can only do that for so long before it has consequences for the politics.
Exactly.
To import people from a much more liberal place. However, there is some nuance to this. If you look at the polling data from the 2018 election, it is true that native-born Texans were trending more for the Democrat in the U.S. Senate race, Beto O'Rourke, and people who had moved to Texas from somewhere else, non-native-born Texans, were trending more towards Senator Cruz, the Republican. Now, why would that be? Well, it's kind of the opposite of what we, just sort of assume is, that liberal people are moving in from a place like California. California has a lot of Republicans in it.
Right.
In fact, I think there are more Republicans in California than there are in Texas. It's just a bigger place, right? They have like 40 million people or something like that, and we have under 30. The problem is there are just, for Republicans, the problem in California is there are just way more Democrats than there are Republicans, right? And so one of the things that happens, just like what happens in New Hampshire, right? The Republicans from Massachusetts
move to New Hampshire. Exactly.
Move to New Hampshire.
And the most conservative part is that boundary. You're absolutely right.
Massachusetts, right? So they come in, and what happens is you get a more concentrated version of a Republican Party, which is one of the things that has contributed to more of a right-wing Republican Party in Texas. People coming from other places seeing it as a conservative,
a refuge, a Republican refuge. And I'm just going to say something. That may be true until now, but as a result of all these incredible fires, the people that will be leaving will not be leaving because of political ideology. They'll be leaving because they can't live there anymore. And that may, in part, change Texas because they're not coming because of the Republican values. They're coming because of desperation, and that's what's so depressing. Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, thank you so much for joining us. If it's Friday, it must be Braddock. Stick around for more radio. We're talking a little bit about Rudy Giuliani, an amazing piece from the Christian Science Monitor. We'll be right back.
Trout in the Classroom on this current cast. Some students across Pennsylvania are helping raise brook trout in classroom aquariums. And it's not just a front row seat to the life cycle of the fish. Amity Daniel of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission says the students also learn about water quality through hands-on activities. For example, by comparing the conditions in the tank to a local stream.
The students are gaining an ownership of the health of the brook trout in the classroom. And through that, they gain a connection to that local watershed.
At the end of the year, they release the trout. The program is over, but for many students, an interest in conservation remains. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
I see trees are green and red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds are white, the bright blessed days, dark sacred nights, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So as a child, my father would read me two newspapers. He would read me the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor. Most fathers would read the Red Fairy Tale book or Grimm's Fairy Tales, but not my dad. It was always the Monitor and the Wall Street Journal. So here I am, 66 years later, I'm still reading the Wall Street Journal. Boy, that's dedication. And I'm looking at the journal, and I see an article by Linda Feldman. She's a staff writer for the Monitor. How long have you been writing for the Monitor, Linda?
Well, I've been in Washington over 30 years.
Oh, my God.
So that gives you a clue of how old I am.
Yes, yes. Well, and I've been following you for a long time.
Thank you.
The piece that you wrote about Rudy Giuliani, I said to you just before you came on the air, I want everything that you left on the floor, let alone what you put in the piece, because it is just so interesting because it pulls together people's names that we recognize. It feels so insidious in a lot of ways. It pulls together storylines. And as you read this, it so explains the Rudy we see today. The title of your piece at the Christian Science Monitor was Rudy Giuliani's Evolution from America's Mayor to Trump Proxy. And what I just found, I just want to read the opening two sentences because I think it sets the stage for the story that you weave that really does give you a sense of who the man is. Peter King, as in Representative King, didn't have much use for Rudy Giuliani when they first met in the summer of 1967. Both were 23-year-old interns at the Wall Street law firm of future President Richard Nixon. Another partner at the firm, future Attorney General John Mitchell, assigned them to work together on a municipal bonds project. Oh, my God. It is such a small world. So, Linda, welcome to the program. And really, just tell the story you tell in this piece, because it is fascinating. And yet the man that you saw at the beginning, who seemed to be so parsimonious and so focused on sort of being the good lawyer, and actually at that point he was a Democrat, and then to see where he is today, it really does feel a little bit about how money corrupts and how money corrupts absolutely. But we'll get to that point at the end. So tell us the story of this Rudy that I didn't really know about, but in some ways it doesn't surprise me.
It begins, as you say, in 1967. So Congressman King, who's in his 14th term as a member of Congress, I had been told that Mr. King went to high school with Rudy Giuliani. So I thought, oh, that'll be great. I'll get a great story about Rudy as a cut-up in high school, let's say. So I call Congressman King, and he tells me, actually, that's not true. We were law interns together in the offices of Richard Nixon on Wall Street in the summer of 67. They were both, Giuliani and King were both law students. King was at Notre Dame. Giuliani was at New York University. They're the exact same age, and there they are working for John Mitchell. Now, this is, of course, before the Nixon and Mitchell became household names.
I know. It's just shocking. But I do want to remind you, while they did not go to the same high school, both went to Roman Catholic high schools.
Yes, exactly. You know, they had, in some ways, similar origins, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Catholic boys from outer boroughs. They're not Manhattan boys.
Right.
And, you know, humble roots.
Mm-hmm.
And both smart, both going to law school, but Peter King says he didn't really much care for Rudy Giuliani back then. He was a Democrat. He was a Bobby Kennedy Democrat.
Oh my God.
King was already a Republican and still is.
Mm-hmm.
King's observation about Giuliani at that time was that he was very reserved and very serious about the law.
Right.
And that Giuliani used to rib King about how he was caustic in his writing. So they're doing this boring municipal bonds thing for John Mitchell. And not only did they work, they were assigned to work together, mm-hmm. King and Giuliani. And not only that, they lived near each other. So they would take the train home at night. They would ride the same train, that Long Island Railroad, out into Long Island, and so they got to know each other pretty well. And I get the feeling that King was actually kind of fond of Giuliani by the end of the summer,
mm-hmm.
But they didn't become friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then 9/11 hit, and suddenly they were in common cause against this terrible foe of the United States that had so damaged Manhattan. And they've been friends ever since. And now Mr. King is a big defender of Rudy Giuliani. And as you say, there's been this big evolution in Giuliani's, not only his politics, from Democrat to independent to moderate Republican to now Trump Republican.
So how does King explain that? Because that was the one thing I also thought was so fascinating. So you talk about the fact that, you know, so King was, you know, almost out of utero, he was a Republican. I mean, that was what he was. He never questioned it. It was what he was. You see this amazing evolution of Rudy Giuliani, but it's not a straight line evolution. I mean, he doesn't become a good Republican. He's a Republican that endorses Mario Cuomo. I mean, you know, so I almost feel like in a lot of ways there's a similarity between him and Donald Trump more so. So then the similarity between him and King, that he basically sees it as a smorgasbord.
Mm-hmm.
And politics is not a straight line. Smorgasbord is, let's take something from this dish. Let's try that dish. And you write here, this is just remarkable to me. In those early days, Giuliani went from political independent to moderate Republican. So moderate, he endorsed Democrat Mario Cuomo for governor in 1994 to Trump Republican and from mob-busting federal prosecutor to celebrity mayor to controversial personal lawyer for President Donald Trump. I mean, who the hell is Rudy Giuliani? And I'm just trying to figure out, does he look at the moment and say, this would make sense for me? Or is there any theme running through him?
I think Rudy Giuliani, well, he obviously developed a taste for the limelight. So even though in his early days as a law intern, he was very studious about the law, he turned into a politician.
Right.
I mean, we all evolve over time. None of us are the same as we were when we were 23
of
years
course,
old.
Of course,
but so Rudy Giuliani decided to go into politics. He became kind of a showman, in a you know, kind of like Donald Trump in some ways. But he did his showy aspect was as a federal prosecutor. And one of the things I didn't mention in the piece was the famous he perp walked the guys from Goldman Sachs in handcuffs. For insider trading,
right.
Before the cameras, and that was a big moment when Rudy Giuliani was just showing how tough he was as U.S. attorney in Southern District of New York.
Well, I hate to say this, Linda, but that's the memory I have, and I was hoping to see that in 2009.
I
was hoping that our Attorney General of the United States would have done the same thing after the economic meltdown, in part because I remembered what Giuliani did with the Goldman Sachs and their perp walk, because I kept thinking, well, we've had the capacity to do this before. Why can't we do it now when there's even more reason to do it? So to a large extent, I almost see him as, you know, that was such a great visual. And I may not have remembered that it was Giuliani, but I remember it happening. So obviously he knew how to play to the cameras.
Right. And you also have to note that at least two of the people that he perp walked out of there were acquitted. So some people are thinking that it was a little bit too showboaty,
right.
And that Giuliani was so into making that statement that he maybe didn't have the goods on these guys well enough. But this was the showy aspect of Giuliani is what made him a successful politician in New York. It allowed him to really grab people's attention and win. Obviously, New York is a very Democratic city, but as a Republican, to win the mayor's office. and win two terms, and even contemplate, you know, a little overtime term after 9/11, which right. of course he didn't get. And, but you know, we also have to recall that by the just before 9/11, Rudy Giuliani was not popular.
People at all.
Tired of him. He had done some good things for the city. He had cleaned up Times Square.
But blacks hated him.
But New York also had terrible racial problems,
right,
which Giuliani was not on the good side of. So I'd say he had a mixed record as mayor. But then his mayorship ended. He decided to make some money, did the money thing for several years, and then runs for president and completely falls flat on his face. So that appears to be the end of his time in the national spotlight. And then along comes Trump. And we get the Giuliani of today.
So does Trump see someone very similar to himself? One of the things you mentioned in your piece, and this was something that Congressman King even referred to, and that, you know, obviously he did certain things as a U.S. attorney, but the other thing that he also knew how to do was either show up on page 1 or page 6 of the New York Post. And what we know about Giuliani, unfortunately we know too much about this, is about his divorces.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
about his relationship with women. I mean, to a large extent, I see Donald Trump going, oh, he's my kind of man.
Yeah, so we know that that Giuliani had girlfriends, that there were three marriages, three divorces. We don't know that he was as
unfaithful?
Well, not just unfaithful, but just unsavory toward women as President Trump. And we don't hear stories of women accusing him of sexual assault,
mm-hmm.
which is what we have against our current president.
Yeah.
We don't have that crude language on tape from the Access Hollywood video, but
right.
certainly I think in Donald Trump, he sees that Donald Trump sees in Giuliani somebody who's similar to him, larger than life, developed a taste for, quote, the finer things. So this is another thing that Peter King says, is that in those early days, really Giuliani was not hitting the nightclub scene. He wasn't. He was parsimonious. He wasn't a big spender. He didn't have expensive taste. But now that seems to be his lifestyle. I think you know, a lot of people mention his soon-to-be ex-wife Judith Nathan Giuliani on that. But
explain something else to me. I mean, as I'm thinking about Rudy and his behavior, he obviously fell flat when he ran for president. I actually have tape of my husband, who's now deceased, but my husband, who was actually at a New England College event and actually asked a question of Rudy Giuliani that Rudy Giuliani got angry at him and could not respond. And it was like this absolute, you know, social media moment, you know, and I'm thinking, yes, Marty, look what you did to Rudy Giuliani. Little did we know that he wasn't going to like last another 2 weeks after that.
Yeah.
But it was just so interesting. But he also, I think, he was courting Trump. He wanted a position within the Trump administration. That never happened. Why did he still stick around? Why was having been sort of thrown out from within the administration was a reason still for him to find his way back in? And then now, in some ways, he's more inside the administration than people inside the administration. And we're beginning to see that that's also part of the raison d'etre for why we saw the, you know, what's happening right now with impeachment, is that Rudy Giuliani has a lot to do with that. He was running, his Ukraine policy even when he wasn't part of the administration. But yet, to a large extent, Ukraine kept thinking, so who am I supposed to be dealing with, the ambassador or Rudy?
Right, exactly. No, this is the story of how Rudy Giuliani got into his current position and entanglement with the president is extraordinary. And you have to point to Donald Trump as well, that you have there's a symbiotic relationship going on here, that you have Rudy Giuliani, who wants to be part of the action. This
right.
is first and foremost
right.
with Donald Trump. So he's one of Donald Trump's personal lawyers. He's doing it unpaid. So
which I don't believe, but keep going.
Well,
someone is writing a check, but not Donald Trump,
Rudy Giuliani is, this is one of his biggest problems, is that he's working his private business as a consultant and making tons of money doing that,
right.
while at the same time being one of the closest confidants of the president. And so if you're a foreign country and you're trying to figure out, say you're the president of Ukraine,
right.
and you're trying to figure out what's going on here? Do I listen to the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine? Do I listen to the EU ambassador who's somehow now involved in Ukrainian U.S. relations?
Right.
You know, there are so many players here, and having Giuliani essentially running this shadow foreign policy is not necessarily illegal, but it's
unusual.
Unusual, yeah.
And let's also remember, let's remind our audience that the president of Ukraine is not a politician. He's a former comedian teacher. I mean, when you understand the guy lacked a lot of political sophistication, obviously he was able to sort of engage. In some ways, he's kind of Trump-like, although he's not like Donald Trump. I mean, he did run on corruption. He didn't have a political history. He didn't have a political portfolio. Everyone knew him because he was an entertainer. But he didn't have a hit. So can you imagine showing up as the president of Ukraine, suddenly realizing that you're concerned about Russia, needing this aid from the United States, dealing with someone who doesn't have a title, who is an attorney for Donald Trump? What does that mean when you're talking about U.S. foreign policy? I mean, you couldn't even set the stage for this. I mean, if there's confusion coming out of the Trump administration, there is clear confusion with what's happening in Ukraine because they have no idea what the hell is going on, and he has no history to even depend on as the president because this is new to him, too.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Oh, my
God. So, yeah. I mean, so we in the media are hoping that as these impeachment hearings, impeachment depositions, and then soon public testimony, that we'll get some answers to these questions. So they've subpoenaed documents from Rudy Giuliani. I can't imagine he'll comply unless a court tells him he has to. But yeah, we're sort of midstream in this story, and you almost need to raw chart of all the characters. It's like a big Russian novel where you can't keep track of everybody, and you need to create a flow chart on who's connected to who in the official channels and the unofficial channels. And
it's shocking. There's a line, however, in your story that absolutely jumped out at me, and it was from one of the pollsters I think you talked to about sort of looking at these players coming out of New York. And I want to remind everyone, I think that didn't Rudy Giuliani actually take on Donald Trump for corruption in the real estate market?
No, he didn't take on Donald Trump directly.
What happened?
He was taking on, it was actually the former deputy mayor of New York, Stanley Friedman, who had gone to work after he left that office. He went to work for the law office of Roy Cohn in New York.
No.
And so Giuliani, as a prosecutor, is going after Friedman, who was corrupt, and in the process had to get into the inner workings of this law firm. This was Donald. So here's Donald Trump. It's 1986. Trump is making his name in real estate at that time and was a client of the firm. And Giuliani, at that time, there are quotes, I don't have them in front of me, Giuliani not thinking very highly of Donald Trump at that point.
Right, exactly. But one of the things that this pollster said was he actually put together three names that I found kind of shocking, but at the same time did not. And he talked about how these people feel that that part of their raison d'etre as they sort of evolve into politics or they've done their political thing or whatever is that money is the thread. And the idea that somehow they deserve it, that they should make it, that, you know, there is no limit to the amount of money that they should make. And the three people that he talks about are Trump, no surprise. He's always been defined by that. He talks about Rudy Giuliani, which to a large extent you'd sort of explain now. I mean, he's wildly successful, even if he's quote-unquote not being paid by Donald Trump. But obviously, he's getting a lot of money from his other clients that are really causing him, I think, a headache at this point in time. But the third person he talked about was Hillary Clinton and the Clintons. And I just thought it was so interesting because let me tell you something, Linda. I kept saying years ago, why did the Clintons move to New York? What was their connection? Their connection was never really to New York. Their connection might have been to, you know, Illinois, Chicago, that's where she's from, Arkansas, that's where he was from, and that's where they lived. But what would attract them to New York, and why would they move to New York? And I suspected that they moved to New York because Bill Clinton did Wall Street a big favor. He deregulated derivatives. He got rid of Glass-Steagall. He did a lot of things that Wall Street could have only imagined would have happened with a Republican president, but in fact, it turned out it happened with a Democratic president. And to a large extent, there was kind of like a political IOU. And then you see what happens. Hillary and Bill move there. Hillary, even though she's an out-of-stater, relatively easily wins the U.S. Senate race. And then the part that breaks my heart is that before she runs for president for the second time, instead of spending time, getting reacquainted with voters, she spent 15 months making $21 million talking to the big boys of Wall Street. At that point in time, Bill and Hillary were already, I believe, the richest ex-presidents ever, even if they left penniless and in debt when they left the White House because of all the lawsuits. And I just thought it was so interesting that what this pollster would point out is their connection between Trump and Giuliani and Clinton. And the connection was money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also love that quote. And I thought it was a very astute observation. And it's not to say that being a New Yorker makes you into money, but people who want to make money are attracted to New York.
Exactly.
The Bill and Hillary Clinton story is that Bill Clinton never sought to get rich. He was always interested in being elected to things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in their marriage and partnership, she was the one who was going to make the money. He could serve as governor of Arkansas for $30,000
right.
a year,
right.
and she would work for the Rose Law Firm and make the money.
Whitewater. Let's invest in something that'll make us some money.
This is openly known that she, there's nothing wrong with this, that one spouse follows their passion and the other makes the money so they can have a comfortable life.
Right.
You sort of spin that forward, and when you've been as high profile as she had been, and including being a U.S. senator, after finishing all of that and then being Secretary of State, and she can make lots and lots and lots of money.
Right.
Why not?
And I also
you
think
can
that
argue
she...
why not, but then when you're turning around and running for president again.
Exactly.
You have you have this foundation and people with lots of money are giving to the foundation.
Right.
And it doesn't look good. It don't look so good.
It doesn't. And I remember this is absolutely true. That's why this whole story, every paragraph was like, wow, I didn't think about this. Wow, I didn't think about this. People, you need to read the story at the Christian Science Monitor about the evolution of Rudy Giuliani. It's just absolutely fascinating. And the names that jump out of here are going to make your head spin. But I remember at one point in time, I know Hillary and Bill. I know them because I ran for governor in 1992. Mm-hmm. They were running for president. I ran for Congress in 1996. They were running for president. So I got to see them in lots of interesting places. And I always used to say that I was always a little bit suspicious about Bill Clinton when he was running for president, because here I was, the sort of consumer advocate on the Commerce Committee back in the late 80s, early 90s, and here I am running for governor as this sort of liberal progressive, activist. And every time I would walk into a room, there was Bill Clinton. And under one arm was the insurance lobbyist, and under the other arm was the banking lobbyist. I mean, in New Hampshire. And I'm like, wait a minute, he's running as a Democrat? But then as I fast forward, I think there was a sense of resentment after putting in all this time and effort in public life that they would leave the White House, and he obviously was burdened by some kind of financial debt because of all the lawsuits. And I think, as you point out, Hillary Clinton was the one that, was the one that would make the money. And I think at one point in time, she probably turned to him and said, okay, I'll run for U.S. Senate, but you continue to make the money. And then once again, money is part of sort of what explains her. And I think that's what's so sad about this, is that what she doesn't quite understand is that she, in part, didn't lose the election because a lot of people like myself didn't want her to be the first woman president. But people looked at that history and that relationship with money, starting with the new Democrat Bill Clinton, starting with her behavior. And I think you are beginning to see, even before the rise of Bernie Sanders, that Democrats are beginning to say, what does the Democratic Party stand for? And are we too wedded to money and too wedded to Wall Street to actually work for working people? And then when you read this story about Giuliani and Trump and Clinton, you begin to realize that money is a real problem, and New York is a real problem, because guess where all the money is? It's in one zip code in New York.
So I'm going to push back just a little bit.
Okay.
I don't think money in and of itself is a problem. It's just how you handle it. It's how you keep it really super separate from your public life. If you're a public official,
right?
Obviously, there are ethics laws that govern your financial relationships, but if you're out of politics, at least temporarily, then go ahead and make money, but just bear in mind that it could come back to bite you, right? If you're building all these relationships with Wall Street, for example, some voters might not like that. So, and American voters on this money thing, I mean, look at all the blue-collar people who love Donald Trump. I mean, Americans, admire people who make a lot of money.
But do they admire – so let me just – Linda, I need to let you go. 30 years with the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, let alone nothing else. You have to come back on, Linda. But one of the things I keep thinking about, do they love Donald Trump because he's so wildly successful and rich? Or do they love Donald Trump because he's doing what the Republicans say they've always wanted to do? He's blowing up government. They see government as the root of the problem. They see government as their burden. They see government as something that really, frankly, doesn't assist them. They look at their incomes going flat. They look at their jobs leaving. And they're going to blame government. And Donald Trump promised to do something, I think, that they found pretty attractive. And that wasn't that he was rich. It wasn't that he had beautiful wives. It wasn't that he lied to them. It was that he was going to do something that they applauded, which was, guess what, blow up government, not respect policy. And frankly, either did they.
So I think it's all of the above. I've been to a ton of MAGA rallies, and I ask people about the fact that Donald Trump is quite wealthy, and they think that's great. I mean, yeah, they want to be wealthy too. They do admire his business, what they see as his business acumen, and they think that because he was a, quote, successful businessman, then he could apply the same principles to government, which we know doesn't really translate,
right.
But that's what a lot of people think, that, oh, and because he already has money, we don't know how much he has.
He doesn't need their money.
Right, he doesn't need their money, that he can't be bought off, he can't be corrupted, because he doesn't need anybody's money, he's got his own money. So I do think the money helps him, both builds the admiration for him among his supporters, but also he can argue that he's doing this out of the goodness of his heart, not because he thinks he's going to cash in someday.
All right, Linda Feldman, Christian Science Monitor, fabulous article, Rudy Giuliani's evolution from America's mayor to Trump proxy. Thank you so much for doing this, and thank you for sticking with the Christian Science Monitor so I have an excuse to call you again.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. See you next week. You bet.